Hello and welcome to Ag PhD Radio. Thanks for joining us today. Oh, I am excited. We're going to be talking about setting up your fertility program for your soils. And just got in a discussion this morning about, do you feed the soil? Do you just feed what that crop is going to remove? Where do you begin with this program? So it'll be a fun discussion on today's show. We're also taking your calls and agronomic questions at 844-44-AG-PHD. And you can email us radio@agphd.com. Brian, talking about your fertility program is our topic today. And I just think almost every high-yielding and successful farmer that we talk to, the first place that they begin is, let's talk about fertility. Let's talk about each specific nutrient and see where I'm at and what I can do differently to be successful.
Yeah, I'd just say for me, the first thing is always drainage. But right after that is fertility. And you asked the question about feeding the soil or feeding the crop. Well, ultimately, we just want to figure out a way to get nutrients into the plant cost effectively to maximize yield and do it profitably by the time we get all done. So I look at it kind of on both sides. In other words, we've got to look at the soil, but we also have to look at just crop removal and feeding the plant and all that kind of thing. So my point here is, like with starter fertilizer, for example, we're big believers in using a low rate of a low salt liquid starter. That's fantastic to get the crop off to a good start, because even if you have a lot of nutrients available, especially in the northern United States or in Canada, we have cold soils in the spring. Well, with cold soils, some of these nutrients aren't available right away, and when you've got a tiny little root system, it's very beneficial to have at least a little fertility. I'm not saying crazy amounts, but at least a little bit of fertility close to that seed and close to where those young roots are going to grab it. So I do think we got to look at all things.
You know, we get so many questions that come in really literally from all over the world on, what do I look at and where do I focus first? And when we do presentations on soil fertility, we've always got this order that you go through the process. Just a simple, hey, look at this first, then look at this, then look at this. Because there's such a focus on N, P, and K, and those are super, super important. But there also should be an importance on some of the other things going on in the soil. And I think about one thing, too, as we get talking about this, because I know it's going to be, let's talk about fertilizer and let's talk about soil amendments and these types of things. We also look a lot at organic matter in our soil, and our goal in the time that we've been farming has been to increase organic matter levels on our farm, because that's where the soil microbes are going to be feeding. That's where a lot of good things are going to happen. And there's going to be a free release of nutrients from organic matter throughout the season each year too. So that's a real positive that I like to pay attention to.
Yeah. And the reason why we do this step-by-step process is because with soil testing, a lot of people get confused by it, because, and quite frankly, I think this should be a mandatory course when you're going for any ag degree in college to learn how to actually read a soil test and put it into practice in the real world, not just the hypothetical stuff. And, you know, I mean, it's great. Science is great, but we have to relate it to what we're doing every day. Otherwise, it's worthless. And I just find way too many people look at a soil test and go, well, I don't even know where to begin. So that's why we talk about, hey, let's take it one step at a time. Always start with soil pH and then work your way from there. And the reason why the soil pH thing is important kind of goes hand in hand with what you're talking about already, Darren, with nutrients. And if you have that pH out of whack, well, you don't have as much availability of certain nutrients. And so what I'm getting at is if you get the pH in line, now all of a sudden more of your nutrients in the soil are available to the plant, which means hopefully you can spend less on fertilizer yet get more out of it.
Well, I like the sound of that, spending less money or just getting a really good return on the investment dollar that I put into this. And when I talk to farmers that don't understand how to read a soil test, I get it. I didn't grow up on a farm where grandpa or dad or my parents, whatever, were teaching me about reading a soil test. But certainly any generation going forward on our farm is going to hear about that and learn about that on the front side, because throwing $100 $100 or $200 an acre out in fertility and not knowing how to judge if you're getting a good return on your investment, that's just crazy in my mind.
Well, keep in mind, though, for, let's say, our grandparents, even our parents, livestock was on the farm. On most farms in the United States, if you go 30 and especially 50 years ago, there's livestock everywhere. Well, if you have livestock, that means you're going to have manure. And if you use manure to fertilize, okay, well, that dramatically cuts down your fertilizer cost. And then the other side of it is yields were so much lower. So you just didn't need to spend that much money in fertilizer. When I say that, that doesn't change the importance of learning how to read a soil test. But we just have so many more dollars at stake today. I just kind of look at our farm where we're spending over $500,000 on commercial fertilizer every year. That's a big bill. But what did our dad spend? $50,000? What did our grandpa spend? $5,000? You see what I mean? So when I've got 100x the spending of my grandpa, well, that means that reading that soil test may be 100 times more important. And here's the other thing. It's not just, oh, let's throw fertilizer out. So manure, oh, that's the best fertilizer. Not necessarily. It has a lot of good things, but it also has harmful salts. So we have to be careful about the salt load. And you have to also be careful about nutrient imbalances. Because if you're short on copper or zinc or manganese or some little thing that you don't even think about, well, all of a sudden, that messes everything else up. So it's still really important, even if you have manure, to understand how to read the soil test, to understand what's actually in the manure or anything you're putting out on that soil. So we're just big believers in test, test, test. And I'm not saying you have to spend crazy money to do that, but you have to spend some in order to help you understand what you really need to do for your fertility program. So we're going to talk about that throughout the day.
We're also taking your calls and agronomic questions at 844-44-AG-PHD. And you can send us an email if you'd like, radio@agphd.com. We'll get to some of those emails as well today. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Pentair Hypro Ultra Low Drift Nozzles are your ideal choice for the Enlist E3 herbicide system. With coverage comparable to flat fans and with 90% less drift, ULD nozzles meet all required standards for Enlist applications and provide optimal performance of contact herbicides. Learn more at pentair.com/hypro.
Your soybeans are in the bin, but the game isn't over yet. Score more points this year by taking your beans to the end zone. At $10 beans, every point of moisture below your target takes away 15 cents per bushel. Reclaim that lost yield with the End Zone Bin System from FarmShop MFG.
Customer service goes a long way when trying something new. Ryan Shaw from Michigan shares how Soil Warrior helped him transition to strip tillage in his operation.
The Soil Warrior guys, they are amazing to work with. They made this jump in this transition extremely painless. One question that I get all the time is, how is the service and everything? And I said, well, actually, I get better service from them than I typically do my dealers uptown. They're just amazing.
More info at soilwarrior.com.
Acre to acre, year to year, generation to generation, nobody scrutinizes performance like you do. And acre to acre, year to year, generation to generation, the consistent performance of Vasgro brand soybeans helps to keep your profitability out in front, offering leading agronomic expertise and 100% exclusive genetics for strong yield potential. Ask your dealer how much further you can grow when Vasgro leads the way. Always read and follow grain marketing and all other stewardship practices and pesticide label directions.
You're looking for soybeans that give you the yield you want. But when it comes to fighting your toughest weeds, you also need flexibility. Introducing Extend Flex Soybeans. Elite genetics with triple tolerance to dicamba, glyphosate, and glufosinate. The yield you want, the choice you need. Learn more at extendflexsoy.com. Always read and follow IRM where applicable, grain marketing and all other stewardship practices and pesticide label directions.
Thanks for listening to Ag PhD Radio. Today we're really excited about the program. We're going to be talking about how to build your fertility plan on your farm. I'm really excited about this. Now, I know not everybody's excited about talking about fertility, but you should be, because you can make such a difference in your crop performance and your profitability if you get this part of the equation correct. So got some great guests to talk about it a little bit. First, we'll go to the state of Iowa. We've got Jim McDermott with us. He's a DeKalb Agrotechnical Agronomist. Jim, how are you doing today?
Doing real well, Darren. How about yourself?
Well, pretty good. Okay, you get questions all the time about fertility, and I would guess specifically about corn and soybeans. But when I look at last year's corn crop and I think of the state of Iowa, there were some exceptionally dry areas of Iowa. A lot of people think, oh, Iowa, it'd be easy to grow crops there. Not so fast. You had a lot of issues last year with dry weather. How did that impact things?
Yeah, we sure did have some challenges, especially in northwest Iowa where I'm at. Overall, I think yields were better than what people expected, but on the fertility side, I think it was limiting. You know, Darren, we usually think of a wet year is where we have a lot of our nitrogen deficiency issues, especially on corn. I would say, surprisingly enough, in a dry year, that can also be an issue. And I did see a lot of nitrogen deficient corn, especially as we were into August and late season, as that plant was trying to fill out and finish the season. So dry weather can certainly have a detrimental impact on that corn's ability to finish. And it certainly saw it this year with the dry weather in west central Iowa.
You know, one thing that we caution growers about, too, is we see a lot of broadcast applications of phosphorus and potassium. And I know in the fall of 2019, there were guys that weren't able to get into some of those fields, and some of those applications got pushed off till spring. Well, if you had to put it out in the spring and you didn't get it tilled down into the soil, I know there's a lot of acres where growers aren't going to be doing the tillage. It's tough for that stuff to come available. Did you see that show up in 2020 as well?
We did to some extent, but you're exactly right, Darren. When we don't have moisture in the top couple inches and we've got a concentration of P and K there, it certainly leads to issues as far as availability. And on the potassium side, when we have dry conditions, especially in some of our higher clay content soils, boy, it just traps that potassium and just does not allow it to be available, even if we've got a high soil test level. So that showed up in some of these extremely dry areas, especially if we were no-till, maybe where the corn roots went down previous root channels. That certainly did lead to some potassium deficiency symptoms later in the year as well.
You know, one other challenge that we've had a number of calls from growers wondering, how do I best handle this situation, is manure application. Coming out of two really wet years, I know there were just times where growers were barely getting enough manure out to be able to continue to operate, and then they're putting it out at times that they weren't used to. Did you run into those challenges here in this last season?
We sure did, and manure is a great source, but it has its own challenges, as you well know. And I think this year, one of the bigger challenges was the compaction, especially going back to the fall of 2019, being as it was wet, coming off a wet year, some of those manure applications were made in very wet conditions. And I don't think we got really the good freeze and thaw through last winter that allowed that ground to loosen back up. So we did have some issues as far as compaction. And in a dry year, when you've got compaction, obviously you've got a double whammy going as far as a reduced or restricted root mass. So that led to some nutrient availability issues as well.
Yeah, it's always a crapshoot. You don't know what kind of year you're going to get. And so we're trying to play the averages when we're farming and make good choices. But you're right, that compaction thing the last few years has been more of a challenge than normal, just trying to get crops in, trying to get crops out. And yeah, we need to have good falls like we had for the most part in 2020 to try to make up for some of those things. Talking with Jim McDermott down in Iowa. Jim, thank you so much. Really appreciate having you on today.
Oh, you bet, Darren. Pleasure to speak with you.
Let's head up to Saskatchewan. We got Tom Weir with us. He's an independent agronomist up there. Tom, how are you doing?
Doing well.
Okay, so this worked out great. We got to have Jim on right before you, so you might be thinking, ah, it's got to be easier down in Iowa. It hasn't been so easy in Iowa the last few years. How about up in Saskatchewan? Has it gone pretty well for you here the last couple of years in terms of getting fertilizer out when you want to and so forth?
Well, we had a tough fall a year ago where it was wet, harvest was delayed, right almost to freeze up. So we didn't get a lot of fertilizer on in the fall. And that threw everything onto the spring, which made it pretty. I mean, I guess our situation is we deal with a really short growing season. And I always joke that we do in 6 weeks what most of the world does in 6 months, because from planting to the end of our fungicide application oftentimes is only 6 or 7 weeks, so it's pretty intensive. And when you throw a fertilizer application in there, it really makes for a busy spring.
You know,
this year was better. We had pretty good applications on this fall. We're back close to normal. So
when everything has to happen so fast, Tom, you're right, you just don't have much margin for error there. How do you focus on keeping nutrients highly available so the crop can get it in that limited time window it's got to actually pull nutrients in?
Well, it's for the most part it's apply prior or at seeding time, and that's when most of our fertilizer goes on. We just don't have the luxury in most years of planning to put on an in-crop application, because, as I said, we've got such a short growing season, and you throw in maybe hopefully a couple of weeks or 10 days of wet weather in there, and you might miss the key opportunity to put it on.
So fall fertilizer is typically the way guys like to go. You've got snow melt, you've got early spring rains, and then really you don't have field operations you have to do ahead of planting. I like that strategy. That's typically what we do here in South Dakota too, but it doesn't always work, like you say. How about in terms of soil testing and setting things up? Are guys trying to get all that work done in the fall as well?
Ideally, yeah. We do see some companies that test during the winter, through the winter, depending on the snow. So far, right where we are, we haven't had very much snow, but you don't have to go very far west, and they get dumped on to the point where it's almost, their season's almost over for trying to test in out in the field in 2 feet of snow. But yeah, for the most part, that's the plan. Usually you try and get out after harvest, mid-October to do your soil testing, and then your applications go on after that, you know, your nitrogen applications. Although we have seen over the years, there's a good chunk of the growers, probably 40 to 50% that put it on at seeding. They have air drills that are modified to either put it mid-row or side-banded. So there's a lot of product goes on that way. And that includes ammonia, which is a little bit different than down where you are, that we put on in some areas. 70% of their ammonia goes on at planting.
Interesting. Yeah, it's like you mentioned, when you've got that compressed time window, it definitely changes things. There's no doubt about it. We're talking, if you just tuned in, we're talking to Tom Weir up in Saskatchewan. He's an independent agronomist up there. All right, Tom, how about when you think about planting time, are you throwing a lot of stuff in the furrow too? You mentioned doing a lot of banding. Is most of that in the furrow, or are you seeing strip till? What types of bands are guys doing?
Usually either side banded or mid row.
Yep.
They will put a certain amount of MAP in with the seed, but you're limited on that, especially with some of our more susceptible seeds like canola, which you can't put very much down, to the point where they have to probably, if they're using the proper rates, have to put some down with the seed row and some side banded or mid row banded.
Yeah, it gets tricky with some of those sensitive seeds, no doubt about it, and all the different crops that growers are going to choose from. I'm talking with Tom Weir up in Saskatchewan. Tom, thank you so much. Really appreciate having you on. And stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Yeah. Revitec fungicide from BASF has been specifically developed for the selective soybean grower who doesn't compromise. If you think good is good enough, if you're okay with just achieving rather than overachieving, if average is your goal, this is not the fungicide for you. Revitec fungicide, brand new chemistry, 3 no-excuse modes of action, 0 modes of compromise. Sounds like the fungicide for you. Revitec fungicide from BASF, that's smart. Always read and follow label directions.
A lot goes into keeping a precision operation moving. The inputs you choose have to deliver results. New Dallaro Complete Fungicide from Bayer offers unmatched consistency and the most complete disease control available. Your corn and soybeans are protected and yields higher even in unpredictable conditions. With Dallaro Complete, you get results you can count on to help keep your precision operation running smoothly. Always read and follow label instructions. To learn more, visit DallaroComplete.us today.
Give your corn a strong defense against stress throughout the season with MycoApply Endoprime SC. MycoApply Endoprime SC uses 4 specially selected species of mycorrhizal fungi to protect your crop against stress. That means more access to water and key micronutrients while building a healthy soil structure for stronger crops for years to come. Stronger corn starts beneath the surface. Learn more about MycoApply Endoprime SC at endoprimecorn.com. Always read and follow label instructions.
It's about time. Applied at Planting, new Xyway 3D fungicide from FMC delivers foliar disease protection from planting to harvest. Active ingredient flutriafol moves from the soil through the corn as it grows for inside-out protection from roots to tassel. For season-long protection, choose first-of-its-kind Enfuro Xyway 3D fungicide. To learn more, call 815-362-7747 today. Always read and follow all label directions.
We now bring you an important news bulletin.
This just in from Live Action News.
Innovation has come to the world of burndown.
New Elevore herbicide controls your toughest weeds, even glyphosate and ALS-resistant weeds like mare's tail and henbit. Talk with your retailer about Elevore herbicide today and ask how you can start elevating your burndown.
Each year brings new and unique challenges to farming, and your operation needs to constantly adapt to meet them. That's why at AgBiome, we're working every day to bring you new and better solutions. Microbial-based solutions that protect your crop and help it reach its full potential. To learn more about how we're doing it, visit agbiome.com. That's AGBIOME.com. AgBiome, feeding the world responsibly. Partnering with microbes for human benefit.
Back, you're listening to Ag PhD Radio. We're talking about building your fertility program on today's show, and I hope you saw a little bit of a difference there depending on where the geography's at. And I don't know exactly where your farm is at, but when you think about climate conditions, how that can really change things, and we talk about a wet year versus a dry year. Love that we had Tom Weir on, just talking about, hey, what about a short year? What about, I love Tom's comment, we do in 6 weeks what the rest of the world does in 6 months. I don't think he's kidding there either. They got to hustle when they've got a really short growing season. My dad grew up in north central Iowa, a really nice area of the country, great soils and a pretty decent climate for growing crops. And I know he had made the comment when he moved north and west coming into South Dakota. And he said, wow, you got to be a better farmer. You got to do things differently when you don't have rain and you don't have a long growing season and those types of things. So yeah, I can only imagine where Tom farms, how much tougher it is up there. Let's head out to California. We've got Bill Brush with us, frequent guest on our show. And Bill, all right, here again. Oh no, he farms in California. That must be easier out there. But man, there are some serious challenges there too.
Yeah, nice to talk to you guys again. I was listening to some of the comments ahead of me, and there's several things I always like to tell the growers I work with. And I said, you know, what's the definition of farming? And the definition I like to tell them is managing risk. How do you manage risk? Well, what control do you have over rainfall? You know, in our northern part of our state, they'll get 30 inches of rain, and some coastal valleys will get 60 to 70 inches of rain. And then you get down into the lower part of the San Joaquin Valley, and a good year for them is 4 to 6 inches.
Wow.
And so we farm essentially a lot of it in a desert. And when do you get water? You know, once we've been in kind of the throes of a drought statewide right now, and where I live here in kind of center of the state, almost geographically, we haven't got a quarter of an inch yet. And so you have to manage your risk. And how do you do that? You know, I tell people the number one input to farming is water, and by far and away, and both by pounds and effect that it has on your crop. But what's funny is that, you know, when you look at your crop, it responds the same way if it has too much or not enough. It has that same look that it kind of shrivels up. And that's because when it has too much or not enough, it's not able to retract the number of nutrients it has to keep that same nice green growing activity, keep the plant healthy and actively growing. Now, that's directly, you know, a lot of people say, well, what's your program? Well, where are you located? What's your amount of rainfall? When does it fall? And then the biggest thing I look at is, what's your soil type? You know, what's the total exchange capacity of the soil? Because if you're sandy, you have a total different set of circumstances than if you have a heavy clay. And those are the kind of the ends of the spectrum. And I heard earlier, one of the really key things is, if you don't do soil testing, you don't know what you need. You know, if Absolutely. You're not doing tissue testing, you're not seeing how effective you are at utilizing the nutrients that you found in the soil and what you've applied. So I think it's really important that you, when you manage your risk, is to have the answers. The other thing I always look at is, I see a lot of people out here, the big deal now is, it's always kind of hilarious, but they say, we want to run a healthy soil program, you know? And so healthy soil to people is putting things that they call sustainable, or things like compost or manures and compost. But they never measure what's in the manure or compost. So if you don't know what you're putting on, I don't think any fertilizer dealer could ever bring you out a buggy of fertilizer and say, here, it's fertilizer, put it on, with you out asking the question, well, what's in it? You know? And yet we're happy to put out manures and compost and not knowing the levels of N, P, and K and micronutrients that we're applying. So I think the farmer's got to get a little bit more sophisticated about what it is I'm putting on my soil, and then what benefit will I derive from that.
With corn and soybean farmers, or continuous wheat farmers, they've got a program for putting out nutrients like P and K, and oftentimes it's a multi-year program. Maybe it's, well, I'm only going to put it out every 2 years, or I'm going to put out this part of my program on this part of the rotation and a different part of the program on the other rotation. How do you handle that with growers raising multiple crops on the same ground in the same year?
Yeah, you do what I call, you know, I know back, made several trips back to the Midwest, and one of the things I've always liked about that is that they pretty much are it's I don't want to say it's easy, because it's a tough environment to farm in, particularly because you're limited with what you can grow. But the thing you can know is that when you apply nutrients, particularly when you're working with good soil testing and good results, you can see where you are moving long term and when I can afford to spend more money and when I can't. Out here in California, where it's almost hydroponic, you're growing that crop with what its needs are. You know, and every crop has a little bit different needs, and some are a little higher potassium users, some are a little higher, you know, nitrogen users, and so you're growing that individual crop. But the things that don't change really to make a crop survive is how well it accepts water. And that goes back to base saturation, calcium, magnesium, potassium, and sodium, and getting those in balance so that you can get the proper drainage to keep that air soil and air water balance so that crop can feed in optimum conditions. That's what really growing is all about, is keeping that soil solution with a proper amount of air and water so that it feeds. Dr. William Albrecht, University of Missouri, said it the best, you know, that, you know, you feed the soil and the soil feeds the crop. But the soil can't feed the crop unless it's balanced to the level in that soil solution, that we have an equal mixture of water and air. When those are in balance, the same amount of air, same amount of water, that's when plants will feed at their maximum. And to get maximum economic yield, that's where we need to try to keep them.
Yeah, having that air balance is really important. I know we talk a lot about drainage and how important that is in farming. You got to have good drainage in the soil. Really, it's as much about oxygen as anything else. Everybody wants to focus on the water because they may see water coming out a pipe at the end of the field. But really what we're trying to do is preserve that air space in the soil. We've got so many aerobic microbes that are out there, and also our root system needs air when it goes down in the soil. So that's a big deal. Bill, one other thing is, as we're talking about soil fertility, for the farmer that has an excess, like for our farm, we fought excess magnesium, still fight it a little bit on some of the farm. Other farmers are fighting excess calcium. To me, those seem to be the bigger challenges than deficiencies, because deficiencies, well, it's just money, right? We can add as we can afford to on some of these things. But when you have to try and take away or offset, that gets to be a lot more tricky.
Yeah, well, what happens to our soil amendments, whether it be the dolomitic limes where we're trying to get magnesium back, or just straight calcitic lime where we're trying to build our calcium in these high magnesium? It's an eternal struggle between the two of those. They're strong cations. They dominate the soil colloids at 80% or above. And so it's getting them in balance, and it's understanding how to use calcium to get that. You know, one of the things that you have to understand with limestone is it reacts highly to acidic conditions. Well, if you don't have acidic conditions in your soil, the one thing you do have is acidic water. Most of our rainfall will be on the lower side of the pH, you know, below 7. You know, I was down and have got friends that do a lot of consulting down in New Zealand, and these guys were getting, you know, they called it meters of rain, you know, 2 to 3 meters, you know. So we're looking at 6 to 10 feet of rainfall. And all that rainfall on the lower end of the globe down there was coming in at about 6.1 to 5.9. You don't think that has a tremendous effect on leaching out calcium out of your soil. So they were wondering why can't I get my calcium up? Well, it's a function of where you live and where you farm. So you have to, you know, there's the whole scheme of things that work on water is related to, but not quite the same as soil. It's easier on one side, but more complex because you've got less control.
Oh, there's so much complexity in solving some of these challenges in our soils, no doubt about it. That's why we're always happy to have Bill Brush on the show. Bill, thank you so much. Really appreciate having you on.
Thanks again. I hope to see you guys back there someday.
You bet. That would be awesome. We look forward to it. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Fill once, plant all day. The Thrive 3D application system from FMC is a revolutionary in-furrow crop protection platform that plants up to 480 acres between refills. The Thrive 3D application system mounts to most major planter brands and can be yours at no cost with the FMC Freedom Pass program. To learn more, call 815-362-7747 today. Always read and follow all label directions.
When it comes to leading herbicide formulations, you know Nufarm. Nufarm brings you Cheetah, a high-quality glufosinate herbicide made right here in the USA. Now for use on a wide variety of crops with glufosinate-resistant traits, including Enlist crops. Its novel mode of action will manage existing or emerging herbicide resistance and provide fast, effective results. This means you can focus more on profitability and less on weeds. Nufarm and Cheetah Herbicide, here to help.
Get tough on herbicide-resistant weeds. Add Tough 5-EC into your post-emergence tank mix and increase control of some of the toughest-to-kill herbicide-resistant weeds that plague corn, such as Palmer amaranth and water hemp. Tough 5-EC is a selective contact herbicide with an underutilized mode of action that provides faster kill and application flexibility for post-emergence control of key broadleaf weeds. Ask your local retailer about Tough 5-EC or visit BelchamUSA.com. Always read and follow label instructions.
Did you know soybean diseases like white mold and sudden death syndrome can survive in your soil even after rotating crops? Prevention of these diseases is a constant battle, and yield loss from an infection can be devastating. The right management plan makes all the difference. keep your beans safe next spring with Heads Up Seed Treatment. Heads Up guards your seed treatment from both white mold and SDS. Stay protected and profitable by asking to have your seed pre-treated with Heads Up. Learn more at headsupst.com.
It's not about how quickly you come out of the gate with nitrogen fertilizer, but how strong you finish the race. High Striker uses patent-pending chemistry to stabilize your nitrogen in a form that lasts longer in your crop's root zone. Because for high yields, your nitrogen must last longer, so you can finish the season stronger. Visit agrotechusa.com to learn why so many growers are going the distance with High Striker treated nitrogen.
Success isn't just about maintaining your operation, how you make out for the season, or how much you can get from each acre. It's about doing precisely what needs to be done to feed your crop and grow your legacy, all the way down to the last drop. AgroLiquid Precision Crop Nutrition. Apply less, expect more. Find a retailer at agroliquid.com.
Listening to Ag PhD Radio. Thanks for joining us today. We're talking about building your soil fertility program, and it's an interesting topic. We just had Bill Brush on. He works out in California with a ton of different crops, and as he was mentioning, you've got anywhere from 60 or 70 inches of rain to maybe four in different parts of the state. So it's pretty interesting how management varies and how fertility is going to be a little bit different. Let's head out to Illinois. We've got Kevin on the line with us right now with a question here. Kevin, how you doing?
Well, good afternoon. How are you all today?
You know, there is no snow on the ground here, Kevin, and it's December 8th. I'm pretty excited about that. I'm not a snowmobile guy or anything like that, so if there's no snow, that means less work for me to have to do outside the house, and the roads are good, so I like it.
That's great. It's about 46 degrees and almost sunshiny, and there's some finishing work going on here. My question is that I called in about, I've been following along this conversation now for several weeks here on trying to increase this fertility. And I'm in a situation here, and I think we've talked about this before, where I'm in CECs anywhere from the, well, some places as low as single digits clear up to the mid-20s, depend upon location on the farm. But I want to talk about a particular field in particular here that soil samples came back this fall, and my CECs are running in the mid-teens to the low 20s throughout this field. And my question is, I'm trying to build the potash in this ground or the K level through potash, because I'm running in the base saturation areas of 2.4 to 2.8, somewhere in that area. And upon getting these, I spoke to the lab technician that ran my samples, and we talked about my fertility program, what I was doing. And I have places, even though out here that the base saturations run those kind of rates, they have as much as 500 pounds of potash that shows up in the samples. And I'd start fertilizing this ground here every acre, every year, in order to try to raise the space saturation. And I was talking to them about trying to go as high as 400 pounds of potash spread per year on each field. And he was kind of concerned in some places on here of, raising the salt load out of bounds to what it should be. Part of my problem is I'm high in phosphate. And, we're talking anywhere from high 90s to low triple digits in this field, and it's just hard to get it out. My pH is fine. We're in the mid-6s across the board here, and my micronutrients are really pretty good, except for really, really high in manganese. What's your all thoughts on this?
Well, you know, as luck would have it, still got Bill Brush with us too. And Bill, you get these questions too about building potassium-based saturation. And we talk a lot about, we'd like to see guys get up to at least 4%, up maybe to 8%, depending on where we're at. Do you see issues with that? I don't see this as being a big issue. 400 pounds of potash on a CEC around 20?
No, not at all.
you know, we run more into a problem where we'll get in super sandy soils where, regardless of the potassium percentage, you can't hold enough pounds. I like to tell people that the crops use pounds. They don't use percentages. And so you got to get that number of pounds up to a level. One of the things he brought up right at the end is that you can get manganese, particularly with can help a tendency to block certain nutrients. And as I'm remembering and believing that potash may be one of them, you know, I always say it's not how many pounds you put on, it's how many you get into the plant. So it's important that when you're putting in potassium, that you're putting it in at a time that will do it. You know, it's not going to beat the race with a big, strong cation like calcium or magnesium. But it sounds like with his pH levels, he could build some potassium there, but he should expect his pH to go up a little bit. But at the end of the day, he still will have a sufficient amount of potassium he can still build there, as long as he's got hydrogen to move out with potassium. But no, I don't think 400 pounds is too much at all in those levels.
You know, Brian, looping you into this conversation too, talking about putting 400 pounds of potash on a CEC of around 20 in Illinois. Kevin's just asking about the chloride, if he's going to run into any issues with that. We've sure done this on our farm. Haven't seen an issue with it here. Would you expect one there?
No. I mean, now granted, I would usually tell you put it on in the fall, but chloride is not a problem. Chloride is an important nutrient for crops, and having lots of chloride is no real big issue. And keep in mind, chloride is fairly leachable. Where chloride becomes a problem is when it binds to certain things, like sodium, for example. Sodium chloride obviously is a salt, and that can cause some issues. But chloride in itself is not toxic, so no, I'm not worried about it.
All right, Kevin, what are you thinking? I guess, did we hit anything else that you brought up? I know one other thing you said is you had some high phosphate and it was hard to get it out of the soil. I was thinking, no, this is going to be fun getting it out of the soil, raising some 300 bushel corn in Illinois.
Well, yeah, it seems to be that it just don't have any problems with phosphate. You know, if I add any, I just add, you know, I'll just do maybe 40 pounds an acre in. You know, year in, year out, when I get these soil samples back, you know, the phosphate level just doesn't change much. And like I said, you know, this is all the way from, you know, the mid-teens up to the low 20s, you know, it's in this particular field. And that was the depth of the question.
Well, thanks, Kevin. We really appreciate the call. Thanks for listening in today, too.
All right. So 400 is not a problem.
No, and I do think one thing Brian said there too, that I would agree with Brian on this, of I feel a lot safer with it doing it in a broadcast versus a band, and I feel safer putting it on in the fall versus the spring. Any other tips you'd have to add to that, Bill?
No, that's exactly what I was going to go to, because you get your enough winter rains there that chloride, being highly leachable, be gone, won't be a problem for the actively growing crop, particularly when you broadcast it. Get those roots out to get a lot more area to get those calcium ions picked up rather than in a straight band. That's not the best way to apply.
And I've got another question I want to ask one of these days, but I'm going to save it for a different call because it's a little bit different what we're talking about now. So, hey, listen, thanks for your help.
You bet. Thanks a lot, Kevin. Really appreciate it. Brian, we got Bill Brush on with us here. And, you know, one of the things that we're struggling with, Bill, has been manganese. I know on our farm, when we have lower pHs, we seem to have more availability. And also where we've got a little higher sulfur levels, it seems like we have more availability of manganese. Is that common? Is that what you're seeing as well?
Yeah, if you look at the availability charts, almost all the micronutrients love that. The more acidic it gets, the more available it becomes. And so if you have good high levels, you're more than likely to get that in. To change pH is just a matter of getting your cap. What's an easier way to put it? If you have a pH below 6.5 and down below 6 particularly, you're missing something, because that means there's too much hydrogen. So the simplistic way to look at it, see what I'm missing in the soil test, add that, and my pH will naturally respond, because hydrogen is the easiest element to move off the soil colloid. And so it's got to be missing, more than likely calcium and magnesium. Find out what it is, apply the amount. The more tricky part is if you are above 7, it means you have too much of something because you have no room for hydrogen. And then you need to find out what I have too much of, and then how do I work to get it reduced down. And then sometimes it's magnesium, sometimes it's calcium. In some cases, it can even be potassium and sodium. And so we've got issues out here with our dairies where, you know, a lot of manure has been applied and a lot of magnesium and sodium and potassium from the sources that they're feeding them build up in the soil, and they have, you know, acidic conditions, but they have way too much. And, the, you know, they're adding, well, I should say, they're adding acidic materials that should acidify the soil, but ultimately things like sodium and magnesium will raise that pH. So
sure,
they then can't get things to come in.
You know, we're fortunate here. The sodium hasn't been a challenge for us, but the magnesium excess certainly has. We'll talk more about building your fertility program right after this.
The only innovation that matters is the one I need.
With NK Seeds, their R&D program actually listens to farmers like me, so I get solutions that solve my challenges.
With the support to make them count. Because progress means pushing my potential, and success matters.
Push your potential at nkseeds.com.
We now bring you an important news bulletin.
This just in from Live Action News.
Innovation has come to the world of burndown.
New Elevore herbicide controls your toughest weeds, even glyphosate and ALS-resistant weeds like mare's tail and henbit. Talk with your retailer about Elevore herbicide today and ask how you can start elevating your burndown.
You deserve to have a building that will last for generations. With more than 110 years of experience and thousands of satisfied customers, Morton Buildings is the industry leader you can trust. Unlike other construction companies, you work with Morton Buildings craftsmen from conception to completion. There's no better time to buy. Lock in your new building for 2020 today. Contact your local Morton sales office or visit mortonbuildings.com.
You need a powerful herbicide to fight the war on weeds. Bellum is Rotem North America's mesotrien herbicide, and it fights against the annual broadleaf weeds attacking your cornfields. Winning this battle means higher yields, lower cost to you, and maximized profitability. For long-lasting residual weed control, check out Evinco Vilify and our newest mix, Rixa. For application, flexibility, and season-long control, that's Evinco Vilify and Rixa, powered by Bellum. For more information, visit bellumherbicide.com. That's B-E-L-L-U-M herbicide.com.
Success isn't just about maintaining your operation, how you make out for the season, or how much you can get from each acre. It's about doing precisely what needs to be done to feed your crop and grow your legacy, all the way down to the last drop. AgroLiquid Precision Crop Nutrition. Apply less, expect more. Find a retailer at agroliquid.com.
Give your corn a strong defense against stress throughout the season with MycoApply Endoprime SC. MycoApply Endoprime SC uses four specially selected species of mycorrhizal fungi to protect your crop against stress. That means more access to water and key micronutrients while building a healthy soil structure for stronger crops for years to come. Stronger corn starts beneath the surface. Learn more about MycoApply Endoprime SC at endoprimecorn.com. Always read and follow label instructions.
Come on in. The Ag PhD mailbag is about to begin.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio. And what we mean by the Ag PhD mailbag is we're taking your calls and agronomic questions throughout the rest of the show at 844-44-AG-PHD. And also your emails, radio at agphd.com. We were talking about And we just had Bill Brush on. He's a consultant out in California, and he'd mentioned you need to have good soil tests. You need to take some plant tissue tests to see what's going on. Got this feedback from Robert in Arkansas. And he said way back in the 80s, the Extension Service was doing some petiole testing for cotton and usually came back with a recommendation for either nitrogen or sugar. And he said it was usually tied to soil moisture, if I remember correctly. If we had adequate moisture, that meant nitrogen was fine and they would recommend sugar. But if we were short in moisture, like we were talking about earlier on the show here today, he said you might get a recommendation for nitrogen. Thanks for that feedback, Robert. We appreciate that. Got this one, Brian, from TJ, who said, what are your key soil ratios for corn, alfalfa, and triticale? I heard you mention an 8 or 10 to 1 ratio of phosphate to zinc. What other key ratios would you like to see, particularly for soils in the 7 to 8 pH range for those crops? And do you change your base saturation percentages that you like to see for any of those crops, corn, alfalfa, or triticale?
No, we don't change the base saturation percentages. I will just say, when we start talking about other crops, I have not seen the research to show me in triticale, for example, that 10 to 1 is the right ratio for phosphorus to zinc. Now, it may be, but this is where, really, for every farmer, you can develop your own data. If you just take your soil test grid samples correctly. And here's what I mean by that. When you go out and sample in a grid, and I don't care if it's grid or zone, doesn't matter. The point is you have to get a GPS point and you sample within, say, a 10-foot radius around that point. As long as you do that, now you can match up what's your yield in that point and what is your soil test data to say. And when you have enough data points, then you can just do a simple graph, and you can compare your yield to all your different ratios that you have in each one of your points. That's what we've been doing. This is our third year now. I'm anxious to see the data back. We've got our guy who hasn't had a chance to analyze it yet, but any day here, I'll have that. So then I'll have 3 years' worth of data from our farm, and we do one-acre grids on over 2,000 acres. So we've got a lot of data points is what I'm trying to say. And because of that, we've been able to show in corn and beans that, yes, 10 to 1, that 10 to 1 ratio is great. Another one that we don't talk about enough is the phosphorus to copper ratio. That's around 30 to 1. And what's happened to us is, so for years we were focused on NPK. Okay, now if you hear us on the show, and just like we've been talking about today, all right, NPK isn't the only thing. So we realized, hey, we're short on copper, we're short on zinc. So what did we do? We put on copper and zinc. But then we realized, hey, we were high in phosphorus, so let's kind of ease back on the phosphorus for a little bit. Well, we were high in phosphorus until we got our zinc and copper levels up. And then all of a sudden, we started to get out of whack in terms of the ratios. Well, when you get the copper ratio down to, let's say, 10 to 1, our yields were down. When we got the zinc ratio down to, say, 3 to 1 phosphorus to zinc, then our yields were down. So, I mean, we've been able to prove on both the high and the low side that we've got issues there, and that's how we were able to fine-tune some of these ratios. In terms of any other ratios, off the top of my head, nothing stands out, but we have them for almost everything, and we've been able to chart that out from data on our farm. And I would suggest you do the same thing, and then you don't have to trust any other expert out there or anything else. You'll have your data from your farm to prove in this crop, whatever it is, triticale or anything, that, hey, these are the right ratios. And that's literally all it takes.
Yeah, I love the idea of generating data from your own operation. It's so important, whether it's getting good soil tests and starting there, but also if you can correlate that to yield, fantastic. Thanks for the question. This one from Diego in Argentina. He said, I wanted to know, how do you calibrate or calculate how many pounds per acre I would need to apply of MAP to increase my parts per million in my soil?
Well, let's say we're doing a 6-inch soil test. And if he's in South America, I realize we got everything metric. And
well,
so
we just had Neil Kinsey on recently, and it was interesting that Neil was talking about phosphorus, and he goes, oh, phosphorus is so complicated for farmers and for consultants because who knows what lab it's going to, who knows how they're measuring, and
right.
Yeah, it gets really tricky.
Yeah, but he didn't ask us anything tricky. He just wants to increase it. So the whole point is you just have to look at what you have in a 6-inch test. And if you have that, that's basically converting parts per million to pounds per acre. You just multiply that times 2, okay? So that's real simple. And then you just need to divide by, well, this is going to get complicated because it depends on if we're going to talk phosphate or phosphorus. And to convert phosphorus over to phosphate, you have to multiply times 2.3. And then you got to look at, okay, he said MAP, so 11520. Then you got to divide by 0.52 because it's 52% phosphate. So anyway, yeah, I understand that gets a little complicated. So did he have exact numbers we can run the calculation
on? Nope, he doesn't. He doesn't have, but if you just said to increase 1 part per million or 10 parts per million, maybe just go with 10. You could say that.
Well, yeah, if I was just trying to increase my phosphorus level by 10 parts per million, then I say, all right, that's 20 pounds of phosphorus that I actually need, okay? Well, that means I have to multiply that 20 times 2.3. Well, 20 times 2.3 is 46 pounds of phosphate. And then I take my 46 pounds of phosphate divided by 0.52, and that's going to give me however many pounds of MAP I need. And let's see, I'm just running the calculator on my phone. So that's 88 pounds of MAP that I have to put out there to raise it 10 parts per million, which sounds crazy. But the problem is the whole phosphorus-phosphate thing. So this is one of the frustrations Darren and I have, and I will just say this. If I owned a lab, a soil test lab, I would do everything in phosphate, I'd do everything in K2O potassium, and I would do everything in pounds per acre. And the reason why is because farmers speak pounds, we don't speak parts per million, and also when fertilizer dealers speak, they're going to speak in phosphate and K2O potassium. So for example, potash, everybody says 0060, right? Well, that's not potassium. That's K2O potassium, which is 1.2 times potassium. Same thing with the phosphate. I mean, when we start talking phosphate, well, that's 2.3 times your phosphorus. So we just have to make sure we're all speaking the same language, and that's why I just think it's imperative in the future that soil labs move to pounds, they move to phosphate, they move to K2O potassium, so we're all on the same page and we don't have to run all these crazy formulas.
Yeah, and the other thing just to keep in mind is you've got to put that many pounds of phosphate out in this case, Diego, above what crop removal is going to be. So if you want to get to a target at the end of the season, make sure you're looking at crop removal. You could use a tool like the Ag PhD Soil Fertility Removal app and start from there so you can find out how much you need. And the other challenge with this, Brian, is just that it's going to vary throughout the field as you've got some areas of the field that yield really well, some that don't yield as much. So to do that and look also at variable rate application, it's, yeah, there's a lot of tricky things there, but certainly if you just said, I want to build my whole field by 10 parts per million, that's how you would do it. All right, one quick one. This came from David. I'm guessing from another country because David says, why don't you guys switch over to the metric system? It makes it so much easier. For example, how much does a bushel weigh? Oh, it's frustrating, but I love your show. Hey, David, we appreciate that. And yeah, you've got a lot of different measurements around the world. We're just working with what we've got here. And yep, I know when we travel, we've got to do all the conversions too. And I know exactly your frustration level with that.
Yeah, it is hard when you're going from our system over to metric or vice versa. So when Darren and I were in grade school, they talked about trying to switch to the metric system in the United States. That never took. So here we are.
Yeah, and they told us it's coming. So be ready for this. So we had to learn all that stuff, which was great. There's no problem in learning, and I think everyone should learn that. But yeah, it just never changed the way we thought it might. Well, thanks for listening to today's program. Really enjoyed the guests that we had on talking about building your fertility program. If you have specific questions for your farm, we're always open to that. radio@agphd.com is how to reach us. Thanks for listening today. Be sure to join us again each weekday for more Ag PhD Radio.